Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. William James' essay, The Will to Believe, has to do with a number of different kinds of belief, but in particular, centers on religious belief. All of the argument and exposition that he has been engaging in throughout the essay, as well as the many examples that he has been providing, are culminating in his position in the end that we ought to be able and free to decide for ourselves whether to believe in what he calls the religious hypothesis. And there's certain conditions involved with this. He doesn't want to embrace any sort of, you know, what we might call rank superstition, right? He says that sad experience makes me fear that some of you may still shrink from radically saying with me in abstracto that we have the right to believe at our own risk any hypothesis that is live enough to tempt our will. Why? Because the freedom to believe what we will can be applied to the case of some patent superstition. But James says, if we put that stuff aside, when it comes to religious questions, we do in fact have the right to decide for ourselves, and it's not irrational to do so. It's not any more irrational than the blanket requirement that we subject religious belief to something like scientific verification or absolute evidence provided through philosophical argument. James says that that would itself be an irrational stance that many people are imposing. And he has, as an example of somebody who has this sort of stance, William Clifford, who said that we should never believe anything anywhere on insufficient evidence, that to do so is wrong, therefore believing in religion is wrong because there isn't any such evidence. So that's all sort of background to where James is heading. He tells us something about the religious belief or the religious hypothesis. He says that science says that things are. Morality says some things are better than other things. By contrast, religion says essentially two things. What is it that religion asserts? Here he's engaging in a bit of abstraction about religions in general. He says, first, she says that the best things are the more eternal things, the, as he calls them, overlapping things, the things in the universe that throw the last stone, so to speak, and say the final word. So the things that are really determinative, the things that are foundational. He says, perfection is eternal. This phrase of Charles Secretin seems a good way of putting this first affirmation of religion. And notice what he says, an affirmation which obviously cannot yet be verified scientifically at all. We can't use the means of science to decide what, in fact, are the eternal, overlapping, and determinative things. That doesn't mean that we can't have any notion of these or we can't verify it in other ways. The second thing that he says, the second proposition is that we are better off even now if we believe her first affirmation to be true. So we're better off if we believe that statement to be true, that the best things are eternal, overlapping, and determinative. And so the one is a claim about value, order, things along those lines. The second one is a statement about what is good for us as human beings. Now, you may not recognize most forms of religion in this rather stripped-down way of expressing it, but this is what James thinks is really at the essence of religion. And it's good to keep in mind that James himself had a lot of experience with religion and religious people and did, in fact, give the lectures the varieties of religious experience. So he's not just doing armchair pontificating. He's saying things that he thinks are really at the core of genuine religious belief, not just mummery or religion and social control or anything like that. Now he goes on and he says, Let's consider what the logical elements of this situation are in case the religious hypothesis in both its branches be really true. Remember, an option has to have two hypotheses. So if we want to say that, you know, there's a religious question, right, or that there's a religious hypothesis that we have to consider, there have to be two sides to the option. What are the nature of these? So first he says that we must admit the possibility at the outset, if we're going to discuss the question at all, it must involve a living option. And here we might think back to some of the assertions that he made at the beginning. His crowd was a Protestant school where he is giving this lecture. And he says that, you know, be a Christian or be an agnostic, these are live options for you. Be a theosophist or be a Muslim, not so much. Now, if you're in a place where there's a lot of Muslim belief and there's a, you know, a masjid right down the road and you can study with that and you know people, that starts to become a live option for you, right? Or, I don't know, if you hang out with the theosophists, wherever they happen to be, or whatever group, those are live options for you. Options are live or dead relative to us. So what might be a live option for me might not actually be a live option for you. I'll mention just as an example of this, when I was in graduate school, having grown up in the Midwest where people, you know, generally either were some, you know, form of religion in the sense of identifying with a religious organization, going to services, having some beliefs, or they, you know, had rejected those beliefs, or they were agnostic or something like that. It was a genuine surprise to me to meet a fellow graduate student who had grown up in Southern California and had grown up in such a secular environment that he really was bemused about what religious people thought they were up to. I had never really encountered what you might call a cultural secularist like that, where these weren't live options for him at all. You know, for me, I could, you know, go back to the church or reject the church or pick some other denomination or embrace something else. But for him, none of those things actually made sense. They weren't live options. So religion offers us a possibility if it is indeed a live option in the form that we're looking at. He also goes on and he says, we see that religion offers itself as a momentous option. What is a momentous option? If we don't take the option, we miss out on something. We can't go back and point to that point in time and redo it or find similar options occurring later on. So he says, we're supposed to gain even now by our belief and to lose by our non-belief a certain vital good. That makes it a momentous option. Then he says, religion is also a forced option so far as that good goes. We can't escape the issue by remaining skeptical and waiting for more light, because although we do avoid error in that way, if religion be untrue, we lose the good. If it be true, just as certainly as if we positively chose to disbelieve. It's as if a person should hesitate indefinitely to ask a certain woman to marry him because he was not perfectly sure that she would prove an angel after he brought her home. Very unrealistic expectations of marriage right there. Would he not cut himself off from that particular angel possibility as decisively as if he went and married someone else? So James goes on and he says, skepticism is not the avoidance of option, it's actually taking an option. So religion offers itself to at least some of us under its various guises or modes as a living, momentous, and forced option between hypotheses. And it's good to remember that James, by this point, has established that when we have such a genuine option such as that, and it can't be decided by intellectual means alone, he says that not only may we decide it based on our passional nature or volitional nature, that is, by willing, by deciding, we must do so. We must do so one way or the other. And so James is making the argument that to forbid that, as many people who argue against religion do, or caution against throwing yourself in or taking a leap of faith, are engaged in doing, is actually an illegitimate stance to take. She says, to preach skepticism to us as duty until sufficient evidence for reason for religion be found is tantamount to telling us when in presence of the religious hypothesis that to yield to our fear of it being error is wiser and better than to yield to our hope that it may be true. And he says that what we have an example of here is not the intellect against passion, but rather the intellect being driven by one passion against the other passions. The person who argues in favor of, you know, don't make any commitments, they're driven by fear, essentially. Fear of falling into error. Or even of you falling into error, because it's not their belief that you're deciding, it's your belief, right? What he says, right? So he says, if religion be true and the evidence for it still be insufficient, I do not wish, by putting your extinguisher upon my nature, which feels to me as if I had, after all, some business in this matter, to forfeit my sole chance in life of getting on the winning side. So that's a key aspect. And that takes us up to a certain point. Then James introduces another wrinkle. He tells us that there's a further dimension or claim of religion. Would this indeed apply to all religions? Perhaps not. Although people often want to bring up, you know, examples of Buddhism and say it's non-theistic. Well, not exactly. Many forms of Buddhism are, in fact, theistic. And so there is no self. True, but there are persons. If you're praying to the Bodhisattva Guanyin or trying to get yourself into the Pure Land through faith in Amida Buddha, that's a regular religious hypothesis. And that fits in with this claim. He says that one of the things that religion tells us is that the more perfect and more eternal aspect of the universe is represented as having a personal form, a form we can interact with. The universe is no longer a mere it to us, but a thou if we are religious. And he says any relation that may be possible from person to person might be possible here. Notice he doesn't say is possible, might be possible. So he says, we feel as if the appeal to religion to us were made to our own active goodwill, as if evidence would be forever withheld from us unless we met the hypothesis halfway, like we have to do with other personal beings. We can't just be in our closed-off bubble and demand that they somehow permeate that and contact us. We have to go out to meet them, as James says earlier, halfway when it comes to matters of liking or loving or any other personal relation to another being. So again, he says that if the hypothesis were true in all its parts, including this one, then pure intellectualism, with its veto on our making willing advances, would be an absurdity, and some participation of our sympathetic nature would be logically required. We would have to go out there and extend ourselves and take a risk of falling into falsehood, but the risk that can also bring us into contact with truth, not merely possessing the truth, but being in relation to the truth, being in a personal relation with the truth. The last thing that he says is that belief is measured by action. So because of that, he says, anyone who forbids us to believe religion to be true also forbids us to act as if we did believe it to be true. And then he goes on and says, the whole defense of religious faith hinges upon action. So here's where James is giving us a sort of pragmatic criterion for whether a person really is embracing or acting upon religious belief or faith. Does it make any difference in their life in ways that can be observed? He says that if the action required or inspired by the religious hypothesis is in no way different than that dictated by the naturalistic hypothesis, then religious faith is a pure superfluity, better pruned away, and controversy about its legitimacy is a piece of idle trifling unworthy of serious minds. So if the religious belief doesn't actually make any difference in a person's life, in their behavior, in what they would do, if they don't do anything differently than they would if they accepted the purely naturalistic hypothesis, that this is all we get, and there aren't any, you know, best things that are eternal or any of that sort of business, let alone personal, then it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't have any significance. It's only when it does lead to some modification of action or a continuance of an action for somebody who continues to live out a religious faith that it would have any significance. So James is providing us here with a pragmatic argument for why it is that not only should we be prepared to accept religious belief on our own part, or at least to entertain it as a hypothesis, and then to try to see whether there's anything there, but also for the legitimacy of other people's faith, which may have to do with very different live options than those which appeal to us. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.